Thus it was, in mid-November 1979, that I began to prepare my motley crew of apprehensive actors for what was soon to become Chariots of Fire. I use the word apprehensive advisedly because in discussion, although none expressed any doubt about his capacity as an actor, not one had expressed any confidence in his athletic ability. But first, we still had to find an actor to play my fictitious hurdler, Lord Lindsay. And it was thus that Putnam and Hudson now brought to St. Albans track a fine young Scots actor, who shall be nameless, for reasons that we will soon appreciate. At first, all went very well, with his running just as good as that of Ian Charlson, Ben Cross, and the others had been back at Putney. True, he had no background in athletics, but then neither had any of my other future Olympians. But soon the moment of truth eventually arrived, when I had to present my Scot with the actual clearance of a hurdle. I put the barrier down to its lowest point at about 30 centimetres. But on being confronted with the hurdle, my prospective Olympian suddenly went pale and refused to make any attempt to clear it. This was perhaps not surprising, for it probably represented for him a personal best in high jump. He was immediately placed in the next taxi to Heathrow Airport by David Putnam, and we all gloomily returned to my home. There, Putnam confessed to me that he had for some time known that our Scot had been known to be susceptible to the occasional dram. I saw no great purpose in discussing the extent of his alcoholic habits, but we nevertheless still had to find ourselves a Lord Lindsay. But now another problem arose a few weeks before I was to set off to the Lake Placid Winter Olympics as coach to our national bobsleigh team. My actors had assembled at my house and we were discussing their training for the 2 weeks I would be away. Then Ian Charlson spoke. "Tom," he said, "we've been training for over a month, but so far, Enigma, they've paid us absolutely nothing." "Oh, so what can I do?" "Well, would you ask them to help us out with a few pounds while you're away at the Olympics?" "Well, I'll certainly give it a try," I said. "So how much would you want?" Ian's response was immediate. £50 a week. I immediately went into my little office to call Enigma to be greeted by an assistant producer by name of James Crawford. His response was immediate. "Impossible," he said. "Absolutely impossible. You see, none of them are on contract yet, Tom, and if we paid them, it would represent an acceptance that they were. So if we suddenly changed our minds about casting, they would have us by the balls." Thus I travelled off to Lake Placid, knowing that none of my men would train on Thursday mornings, because they would all be at their employment exchanges, receiving their dole. But when I returned from the Olympics, there was a turn for the better, for I suddenly located my Lord Lindsay in the angular form of Nigel Havers. Fortunately, by this time we had been forced to move indoors because the manager of the St. Albans track, fearing for the delicate winter surface of a cinder track, had banned me from using it. Thus we had now moved to a large indoor area at Haringey, where Nigel was now proving to be an apt pupil. Up to that point, all of our training had been conducted in warm-up shoes in order to avoid injury, but I had decided that the time was surely right to move on to wearing sprint spikes, and had ordered a pair of Adidas shoes for each of my actors. That eventful Haringey day in March 1979, we had just completed what had been an excellent session, and I intimated to the squad that their Adidas sprint spikes had now arrived. There was something close to hysteria when this was announced, because for them this would be the first time that any of them had ever worn spikes. I then doled out the shoes, but first I sternly warned them that on no account should they now try to run in them, for the session was over, and I turned away to take care of my 3-year-old daughter Kate. But suddenly there was a scream from just behind me. It was naughty Nigel, for not only had he put on his spikes, he had even attempted to hurdle in them. And no, he had not hit the hurdle, and fallen, no, Nigel had probably never even reached it. He had simply tripped over his spikes, smashed into the barrier, hit the ground hard, and damaged his left wrist. But he was now clearly in considerable pain, and Ben Cross immediately offered to drive him to the accident and emergency at the nearby Middlesex Hospital. I agreed, and asked him to get back to me on Nigel's condition later that afternoon. A few hours later, Ben reported back to me that Nigel was now absolutely okay. He had simply tweaked his wrist and would be absolutely fine for the next session, and I phoned Nigel to confirm this. I heaved a sigh of relief, for Nigel was a lovely guy and had taken to hurdling really well. But what I was to discover several years later was that Nigel had actually broken his wrists, and that neither of them had probably got within a mile of the Middlesex Hospital, who would have immediately encased Nigel in plaster, putting him out of the 1924 Olympic Games. No, naughty Nigel had simply bought himself a thick, wide leather strap and tightly bound it round his left wrist. A few years back, after a BBC interview with him, he showed me that wrist, and it was like something out of a Hammer movie. So please let's hear no more about wimpy actors. Earlier, at my suggestion, Colin had agreed to add a Highland Games sequence, one in which we could introduce Little as a sprinter. But where, now asked David Putnam, might we film this, and what would it look like? I immediately sketched it out in my schoolboy scrawl, a drawing encompassing two mountains, a stream, a farmer's field, dancing platforms, and a couple of tents, a grazing cow, a typical game scenario. Putnam had immediately asked me where he might be able to locate such a Brigadoon fantasy, and I directed him up to the far north, where a lordly member of my Olympic bobsleigh team had assured me that he owned exactly such a landscape. Thus it was that David Putnam made his way in his battered Volkswagen north, up into the depths of the Highlands, Welland and Hudson at his side, only to find that the promised site was nothing remotely like my exquisite work of art. Disappointed, desolate, the three men chugged slowly south through the Highlands. Then suddenly Colin Welland wound down the car window and whooped triumphantly. There it is! There it is, over there! Just like Tom said! And indeed it was! There it was, exactly as I had predicted. The two mountains, the winding stream, the grassy games field, just longing for the dance platforms, the tents, the cabers, the expectant crowds, even the cow. And it was there, near Crieff, that we were to film our Highland Games. But now filming began in early April, not in Scotland, but at Eton, the track near Windsor, which stood in for the Cambridge University facility. This was because the university dons, having read the script, felt that it portrayed the university as anti-Semitic and refused to permit filming there. Thus, Hugh Hudson's Eton was to stand in not only for Cambridge, but also in later film for the French track on which the American team would prepare prior to the Paris Olympics. This sequence, featuring the American athletes, which actually took place in May after the filming of the Olympic Games, had to be carefully choreographed to ensure that the exercises shown were representative of the period. In stark contrast, the Eton exercises, which we filmed featuring Musabini and Abrams, bore no relationship to those deployed in a Pathé film made in 1923. These drills showed Abrams deploying a ludicrous cross-arm sprint action and running at top speed with an equally ridiculous forward lean. Looking back as a coach, it seems odd that Musabini, in any of his writings, admitted that Abrams actually always sprinted with a conventional arm action and a vertical body position. It is therefore difficult from this distance to see what technical advantage Harold Abrams secured from Musabini's coaching. Things were going swimmingly in those early days at Eton, at least to the point where I was instructing Ben Cross in digging starting holes for the first time. For suddenly, the grim shadow of Hugh Hudson appeared above us. "You can't do that here," he said. I looked up. "Why on earth not?" Because this is Eton," he spluttered. "Bollocks," I replied. "Keep digging, Ben." Then came the famous race round the Trinity College Quad, which would now have to take place at Eton, over about a third of the Trinity distance. This was another Welland fiction, because Abrams had never actually made that run of 370 yards within the 12 chimes of the Trinity clock. No, it had been achieved by the 400-metre hurdler, Lord Burley, in 1927, and he had done it on his own, not in a race with an imaginary Lord Lindsay. But the main problem would be that our Eton run would be over much less than half that distance on concrete and with consequently very tight turns, a test that no athlete in his right mind would ever have dreamt of attempting. Fortunately, Nigel Hayes and Ben Cross survived this dangerous Eton ordeal unscathed, and I heaved a sigh of relief, because any injury might well have stopped chariots in its tracks. Truly, the gods had now smiled down upon us.
Next time, the Highland Games, and some disagreements with the director.